G'day wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Treasures from the Tanakh on truthtoyou.org. That's truth number two, letter U.org. I'm Jono, and joining me is Torah teacher Ira Michelson. G'day, mate.
It's good evening here.
But good evening? We don't really do good night. We don't have a good night.
What do you guys say?
We have a good day all round.
What do you say when you go to sleep? G'day.
We don't say good night.
I mean, I don't know.
What do we say? I suppose we say good night, but that's like when we're going to bed. It's not as if we're getting together and I introduce Ira Michelson. Good night, Ira. And then we go.
What do you guys do when you get up in the morning? Do you say good day?
Good day.
Good day.
Yeah. Okay. It's the same as Yom Tov, right? That's Hebrew for good day.
I know, but we say Boker Tov.
Sure.
Good morning.
Good day.
Okay.
That's what we do. Now, we're in Job. Chapter 40 to 41. Oh, come on, Ira. This is a wild ride.
It is indeed.
There's some wild stuff in here. It really picks it up in these two chapters. And well, we may as well get straight into them. Shall I start reading?
Sure.
Moreover, Yehovah answered Job and said, "Shall the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? He who rebukes God, let him answer it." And then Job answered Yehovah and said, "Behold, I am vile. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand over my mouth. Once I have spoken, but I will not answer. Yes, twice, but I will proceed no further." And I think, as I said last week, if I were Job, I'd just want to crawl into a cave and close it over and never come out again. But then Yehovah answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Now prepare yourself like a man." Again, he says, "Man up, Job. I will question you and you shall answer me. Would you indeed annul my judgment? Would you condemn me that you may be justified? Have you an arm like God, or can you thunder with a voice like his? Then adorn yourself with majesty and splendor, and array yourself with glory and beauty. Disperse the rage of your wrath. Look on everyone who is proud and humble, and humble him. Look on everyone who is proud and bring him low. Tread down the wicked in their place. Hide them in the dust together. Bring their faces in the hidden dark, bind their faces in the hidden darkness, then I will also confess to you that your own right hand can save you." Now, you know what I've got, by the way, before I let you comment on that, that's verse 14. I do like the way that my new JPS puts it as well. In 14, it says, "Then even I would praise you for the triumph of your right hand won you."
Right. And praise is a good... Praise is actually the right translation there, that mm-hmm. I praise you. Obviously, we talked a little bit last time when we were doing the last chapters about sarcasm and the way God seems to get a little bit sarcastic with Job, and we see this continuance here. I mean, we see in these first 14 verses, obviously, that he's dealing a little bit differently. And then it's going to change over into the kind of the same theme that we saw last time in 38 and 39, where we see, you know, him talking about creation and the creation of the animal kingdom and the different animals and so forth. We're going to see that again. Mm. But first, he deals with Job as it relates to these first 14 verses as if, "Who are you, Job? Are you going to take my place? Are you going to take my job? Do you think you have the ability to do all the things that I do?" Which he's done in the past. He's questioned him about that. But looking at verse 2 is very interesting. Can you read that in the translation that you have?
Yeah, sure. It says, "Shall the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? He who rebukes God, let him answer it."
Right. So, if we go back and we look at, I believe it's in Job chapter 13, we see the same, not similar wording, but one of the same words. And when we look at verse 2, it says, "Harov im Shaddai Yisol Mochiach." And that word Mochiach there is the one that has to do with this idea of contention that we talked about, what you just read. But when we look at chapter 13, verse 32 and 33, in verse 32 it says, "For he is not a man as I am, that I might answer him, that we should come to trial together." And then he says, "There is no arbiter or mediator or umpire between us who might lay his hand on both of us." So I wanted to bring that, to bring up the point that what God is saying now is he's answering Job, and Job understands what God is saying now. You know, it's bringing it back to that trial. It's bringing it back to the courtroom. Remember, we started at the very beginning, We're almost at the end of this book, but we started at the very beginning talking about the divine council, talking about this this courtroom drama that was taking place between God, between, you know, the Satan, the adversary that was coming. And then we see God looking, not God, but Job looking for the mediator. We talked about Elihu possibly being that mediator in here. And in verse 33, it actually uses that same word, mochiach, in Job 33, and this idea of a mediator or an umpire. And so I just thought it was relevant that we bring that up and bring up the idea that God is now answering Job in a way that he understands, saying, you know, are you going to contend with me? You know, are you going to believe that you have the ability to take me to trial, basically, and prove that you're right? Mm-hmm. And that's when Job starts to realize. And in a way, even though God is being very sarcastic in these chapters, I also see him in a very loving kind of way trying to draw Job out to the understanding that he's wrong. And he's doing it in a very powerful way, but we'll see that in a way Job becomes vindicated through the whole thing. It's not Job who, you know, who is punished, obviously, and we don't want to go too far, but obviously God wasn't too pleased with the friends because he didn't think that he was well represented by them. So Job really is the one who ends up being vindicated through this whole thing. And it really is because I feel that in these chapters that God draws him out. Even though it's in a very strong way, it's in a with a very loving hand trying to draw Job out to the point that he really understands that he's wrong. And of course, he admits that later on.
And we will get to that. But this is where it really becomes, this is where it gets a little bit wild. And this is from verse 15 on. It says, now, and we have commented on these themes before, but we're going to do it again in perhaps a little more detail. From 15, it says, now look at the behemoth, which I made along with you. He eats grass like an ox. See now, his strength is in his hips, and his power is in his stomach muscles. He moves his tail like a cedar. The sinews of his thighs are tightly knit. His bones are like the beams of bronze. His ribs like bars of iron. He is the first of the ways of God. He is the first of the ways of God, Ira.
It could be only first of the works of God, too, could be a good translation of this.
Only he who made him can bring near his sword. But he is the first of the ways of God?
Yeah, I want to go back first.
Let's go back.
Let's go back to the description here. Because, you know, and you know, I'm not trying to say this in kind of a funny kind of way or in an offbeat way. But, you know, in verse 16, it says, behold, his strength is in his loins and his power in the muscles of his belly. And when it talks about the tail, it's talking about he makes his tail stiff like a cedar. The sinews of his thighs are knit together.
So are you telling me that he's talking about his genitals?
Yes.
Really? No, well, you know, that's not so far-fetched because we know that thigh is used repeatedly as a euphemism for the genitalia of a male.
Right, and it's about his loins. It's really talking about his loins and not his thigh, even though that's what you have. And so all of this is pointing towards that. And so when it talks about the stiffness of his tail, you know, look, when we talk about the behemoth, you know, we're talking about potentially one of two. Well, actually, there's three or four, but I think the major one or two possibilities are either the elephant or the hippopotamus. And really, interestingly enough, of land animals, those are the two, you know, elephant is obviously the largest land animal, but of the two largest land animals, these are the two that would have the largest genitals as well. Mm-hmm. Of course, there's other opinions that it could be a water buffalo, and then, of course, there's opinion that it could be a mythical creature, although I don't believe that. And the reason why I don't believe that is we'll see as we go forward that there's a description of behemoth.
I'm going to lean towards the water buffalo. I have a reason for that.
I'm going to lean towards the hippopotamus, and it's only because I like to say the word hippopotamus.
I'm going to come back to that.
I actually have a reason why I believe it's the hip. Yeah.
Okay.
One of the main reasons. I don't think, you know, again, not to be funny about this, but I don't think that the water buffalo stands up against the elephant and the hippo when it comes to the stiffness of his tail, let's just
say. So verse 19, he is the firstborn over all creation. That's not what it said.
That's not what it said.
Verse 19 says,
wait a minute, are you trying to bring us?
What? What am I trying? What do you mean?
I don't know. Well, I mean, what you just quoted is really from the New Testament.
Oh, was it?
Yes. Yeah.
It must have reminded me of that. And he's the first of the ways of God. What is that, a different thing?
Well, I mean, it is what it is. I mean, it says what it says. It says he is the first of the works of God. Let him who made him bring near his sword. You know, what you just quoted, and I don't know if it was a Genovian slip or a Freudian slip or what you would call it, but what you just quoted is actually in the New Testament from Colossians chapter 1, verse 15.
Well, hang on, let me look it up. No, I've got it. Colossians 1, chapter 15. No, well, verse 15. Colossians chapter 1, verse 15 says, he is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation.
You know, certainly not trying to compare, you know, what people believe about Jesus with, Job chapter 40, verse 19 and Vehemoth, but, you know, very clearly says here in the Tanakh that Vehemoth is the first of the works of God or the first of the ways of God. So how could somebody else be the firstborn of all creation? When
there's a couple of first things that are disputed, isn't there? I mean, for example, Israel is described in Exodus as the firstborn son of God.
Exactly.
Mm. In my new JPS, it says the first of the works of God. I like that.
Yeah, and that's what I believe. I believe there's some other versions that say that. I believe in even some of the Christian versions. I believe the ESV says that he is the first of the works of God. But it says Hu reshit darchei el. You know, and darche can be the ways of, or it could be the works of. He is the first of the ways of God. So ways actually is the same thing as saying the works of God, because the ways of God relates to his creation.
Sure. And it goes on to say, only he who made him can bring near his sword. Surely the mountains yield food for him, and the beasts of the field play there. He lies under the lotus trees. He lies under the lotus trees in a covert of reeds and marsh. The lotus trees cover him with their shade. The willows by the brook surround him. Indeed, the river may rage, yet he is not disturbed. He is confident through the Jordan, though the Jordan gushes into his mouth, though he takes it in his eyes, or one pierces his nose with a snare.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now, So this would be a good time for you to tell me why you believe it's the water buffalo, and then I'll tell you why I believe it's the hippopotamus.
Okay. Because you may recall, Ira, we have spoken now in the English translation, right at this point, Job chapter 40, verse 24, it then switches over to chapter 41, verse 1, whereby we begin to talk about Leviathan. Now that's different in the Tanakh, right? What have you got as far as chapter division is concerned?
So the first eight verses of chapter 41 that would be in the Christian Bible, like in whatever the NASB or the KJV, is actually part of chapter 40 in Job. So Job in the Hebrew Bible goes up to verse 32.
Now we have spoken about Leviathan as well in the past. And we did speculate, at least I speculated, and I think this might have been based on, Psalm 74? I think it might have been Psalm 74. Let me just go there now. Oh, yeah, it was. Okay, Psalm 74, verse 13 and 14. You divided the sea by your strength. You broke the heads of the sea serpents in the waters. You broke the heads of Leviathan in pieces and gave him as food to the people inhabiting the wilderness. And I floated the idea, maybe Leviathan has fins and scales. Maybe he's totally kosher.
Is that where you wanted to go to the Talmud?
That's where I wanted to go to the Talmud, because the Talmud has some it's got some wild Jewish imagination going on there.
The Talmud actually says that in those days, that God will slay Leviathan and Vehemoth.
And Behemoth, so we're talking about both of these in some great eschatological banquet. Quick, messianics!
Yeah,
eschatological and banquet in the same sentence.
Yes.
I bet their ears opened up then in Baba Batar 74. And this is why I think, well, you know what? I don't think that God is good. Now, if, you know, I'm not the Talmud guy, right? I'm just going to admit that right now. But I don't believe that God is going to serve up reptile and pig at some great eschatological banquet, if this is correct, right? And so I like to think that we're talking about a water buffalo, which is entirely kosher, and the possibility that Leviathan is, in fact, some kind of fish with fins and scales. I think I have maybe three. Do I have three or maybe two or three verses that may support something like that? What are your thoughts?
So, remember, again, we've had this discussion off the air about Talmudic passages and the fact that not everything in the Talmud is going to be taken as literal. There's a godic material in there, just like we have interpretations in Judaism of, you know, we have the whole concept of Pardes, where we have Peshat, Remez, Drash, and Sod, you know, in interpreting different levels of interpretation of a Tanakh mm-hmm. passage. You know, the same thing is true of the Talmud. The Talmud, again, is a style of argumentation that's brought to bring a perspective. Sometimes it's bringing a perspective on argumentation over a specific way of doing something, a specific way of praying, a specific way of doing one of the particular mitzvot, you know, that we're called to do, or one of the melacha, one of the works that we're not supposed to do on Shabbat, for instance. And there's this whole argument that goes on with the rabbis bringing extreme and sometimes absurd arguments. And the point that's being brought out is that we bring every extreme, even absurd arguments, so that when the rabbis make a decision as the majority, then we know that we're following at least the right thing, or what we believe is the right thing.
This is really neither of those, because this is not speculation on how one should conduct oneself.
But the thing is that when we go into this, this is the first rule that we always have to do when we're going to look at the Talmud. We have to understand that when we look at the Gemara is the commentary on the Mishnah. But if you're going to look at these things, you can't just, it's just like anything else. It's just like when we study the Tanakh. One of the things that you and I have a problem with is somebody that comes to us and says, well, this verse says this, okay? Like, just off the top of my head, somebody comes to us and says, Leviticus 17:11 says that there is no atonement without blood, okay? But we come back and we say, well, wait a minute, what about the beginning of Leviticus 17 that talks about not ingesting blood, not eating blood?
Sure, sure.
Okay? We don't just take that verse. So in the same
context is king, Ira.
Right. Context is king. What I always say is text without context is pretext. Okay. And unfortunately, we don't have as followers of God, we do not have the luxury of having preconceived notions. Mm-hmm. We have to look at what God's word says. And even the Talmud says that no other interpretation oversteps the Peshat. We always look at the Peshat first. We always look at what the simple meaning of the text is. Then the rabbis or the commentators will elaborate on it. So we have to go back to the Mishnah and see what is the Mishnah, what is the law that's being discussed, so that then when we look at something like that, then we can try and make sense of it. So you know, honestly, off the top of my head, in Bava Batra, I don't know what the Mishnah is.
Let me throw it out there in a nutshell, just for people who mm-hmm. do want to go and do their own study in regards to this, because you know it's some good stuff here. Bava Batra 74b concludes. Now these are the notes in my new JPS. Okay, concludes that originally there were two Leviathans, one of each sex, who might have procreated and taken over the cosmos. Therefore, God castrated the male and killed the female and preserved her in soul to be served up at the great eschatological feast to which all the righteous will be invited, and at which the principal food item will be Leviathan. It was but one more step to note that Behemoth, which is paired with Leviathan, only in Job 40, verse 15 to 32, must represent another principal food item to be served up at the eschatological banquet, namely a choice kind of beef, also called shohabah, i.e. the wild bull. A further leap, of the Jewish imagination led to the realization that the menu for the eschatological banquet, which certainly could not have provided only fish, and which included both Leviathan conceived of fish and Behemoth conceived as beef, must also include some kind of fowl. This last menu item was provided by the enigmatic Ziz, translated as creature of the field by the new JPS, and it goes on to talk about that. But in any case, it's interesting that at least we should acknowledge that a lot of thought and speculation and imagination has gone into this particular chapter, because it's pretty mysterious, you've got to admit, Ira.
Oh, there's no question. So I'm looking back, and here's the Mishnah, okay, that's being spoken of. It says the Mishnah on this is, he who sells a ship sells implicitly its mast, sail, anchor, and all the implements needed for directing it, but he does not sell the crew, nor the packing bags, nor the stores. If, however, he said to him, it and all that it contains, then all these are included in the sale. So you see, this is a Mishnah that's discussing selling ship and mm-hmm. and what's included in that sale. So that when we look at that, to me, that's always important, because that gives us an understanding of the discussion that goes back and forth. So, and then, like I would study the Tanakh, I will go and I will look at the chapter before, the chapter after, and see what is the discussion that the rabbis were making, you know, in this situation. And then the Mishnah is even broken down. They'll take specific sentences, you know, and they'll break that down and then discuss them.
I'll tell you what, Ira, whatever is the case, and people should, you know, if they're interested, they should go and read it in context and come to an informed conclusion in regards to that. But whatever is the case, I'll tell you where I'm going to stand on this. I'm going to say that that Leviathan is a fish species. Perhaps it's a long fish, and we know that there are such things, a long serpent-like fish with scales and fins and scales, and that Behemoth is of some sort of beef, bovine variety that is kosher to eat. Water buffalo would be an example of that. Right. Mighty, powerful creature that it is.
Right. So let's look at this. So what actually, Job is even quoted in this tractate in 74b, earlier on, before what was being referred to there. It says, our rabbis taught, it happened that Rav Eliezer and Rav Yehoshua were traveling on board a ship. Rav Eliezer was sleeping and Rav Yehoshua was awake. Rav Yehoshua shuddered and Rav Eliezer awoke. He said unto him, what is the matter, Yehoshua? What has caused you to tremble? He said unto him, I have seen a great light in the sea. He said unto him, you may have seen the eyes of Leviathan, for it is written, his eyes are like the eyelids of the morning, which we're going to see in chapter 41. Okay. And it says, Rav Ashi said, Rahuma ben Natan related to me the following. Once we were walking the desert, and we had with us a leg of meat. We cut it open and picked out the forbidden fat and put it on the grass. While we were fetching wood, the leg regained its original form, and we roasted it. When we returned after 12 calendar months, we saw those coals still glowing. When we came before Amenar, he said unto me, that grass was Samtre. Those glowing coals were of broom. And it goes on and on. It goes on, again, talking about, and God created the great sea monsters. Here they explain the sea gazelles. Rav Yochanan said this refers to Leviathan, the slant serpent, and to Leviathan, the tortuous serpent. That's where we're talking about this too, right? Mm-hmm. For it is written, in that day the Lord with his sore and great and strong sword will punish Leviathan, the slant serpent, and Leviathan, the tortuous serpent. And then it goes into this whole discussion. And it's talking about a mnemonic here, okay?
Mm-hmm. And so now that's Bava Batra 74. Psalm 74 is the one that says in verse 14, he broke the head of Leviathan in pieces and gave him as food to the people inhabiting the wilderness. So it's edible. And it's also Isaiah 27.
27
that we quoted, verse 2. Yeah, that's right, that we quoted last time, 1 and 2. In that day, Yehovah, with his severe sword, great and long, will punish Leviathan, the fleeing serpent, Leviathan, that twisted serpent, and he will slay the reptile that is in the sea is what I've got. But I don't think it says reptile in the Hebrew.
The reason why they bring this argument and the two is because one of the things that's believed, obviously, is that when God created them male and female, and that he created them as well in the animal kingdom like that.
Of course. Yes,
of course. This is why it's bringing up the idea of two of them, of Leviathan. It's talking about the male and the female.
Very fair.
But anyway, so you gave your perspective, and I understand why you're bringing the perspective. But
let me just give one more verse. Let me just give one more, and that's before we move on. I think it is Amos 9:3.
Okay.
Because we talk about serpents, and you tell me whether this is fair. I honestly I'm open to suggestion. I'm not standing on this 100%, but I wonder if it is fair. That's now nachash is the word, right? If I remember correctly.
For a snake?
For a serpent.
Nachash is snake or serpent, yeah.
Now, what is the meaning, like, what is the literal meaning? Does it actually mean snake or reptile?
Well, now you're getting into something very interesting.
Uh-huh. Let me tell you why I asked, because it also, see, when we talk about nachash, there's something like 31 references in the Tanakh. And they're all referencing what can convincingly be a snake, a reptilian snake. However, not all of them.
But do you also know that sometimes it refers to angelic creatures?
And seraphim.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. But so fiery ones, but that's seraph, that's a different word. But also it can be talking about the bronze, but then again, it's a bronze snake. But when we come to Amos chapter 9, verse 3, I think it says, and they thought they hide themselves on top of Carmel. From there, I will search and take them. Though they hide from my sight at the bottom of the sea, from there, I will command the serpent, Nachash, and it will bite them. And I wonder if that's referring to Leviathan. And I wonder, really, if it is a reptilian serpent or if it is just a fish. Give me a definition of nachash.
Well, I mean, it depends on the context of the verse that you're talking about. It can mean several different things.
Okay.
It depends on where we're talking about. Sometimes it can refer to bronze or copper. Sometimes it can refer to the snake or the serpent. And the reason why I see that is because typically, if you look at the Middle East, and you look at what type of serpents they had, and certainly when it refers to the fiery serpent, they were that color, the shefifon. You know, for instance, and I think we talked about this earlier on, the saw-scaled viper, which is indigenous to that area, which has the ability to jump. You know, it stays in like rocky areas, but it has the ability to jump to the height of a man. You know, 4 to 6 feet in the air. They have this very kind of coppery bronze kind of color to them. So it's one of the reasons why that's used as it relates to the serpent and the snake as well. You know, we see that.
Can it just be in reference to its appearance, the way that it looks?
It can absolutely, and we're going to see that in Job as we move on, because it discusses Leviathan and it discusses some of the things, like when it talks about eyelids. You know, it talks about the way in which very poetic language, and that's important that we understand that, because we're going to see things that we don't understand that are very poetic in nature. And this is the same thing that I'm trying to get people to understand when we look at Agadic material, when we look at the Talmud and we recognize these things, not in the literal sense, so that when, of course, you read that, I understand why you're saying it, but it's not necessarily that this is actually going to be a physical sit-down dinner where God is going to serve this and that it necessarily has to be kosher.
Oh, sure. No, that's fair enough, too. For me, at the moment,
perspective now on why I think it's the hippopotamus.
Oh, go ahead. Yeah. Why do you think it's the hippo?
Okay. Well, for one thing, the idea of the lotus trees. Okay. When you do search in botany, one of the genuses that they believe that it is one of the things you'll see is the hackberry tree. Okay. Which, by the way, is one of the favorites of the elephant. So the elephant is not out of the mix here. The hackberry tree is actually one of the favorite things that elephants eat and is indigenous to Africa. Okay, so it's not unusual to see that. And being the being the heaviest land animal, it certainly puts it in the running for this. However, the hippopotamus also loves to stay in the water. And we see that idea of the water raging and him not being upset. When you look at hippos, hippos almost always stay in the water. They're always in the river, sometimes only with their head above water. And certainly when they go under, nothing bothers them. It doesn't bother them when they're in the water. But the hippo doesn't sleep in the water. The hippo sleeps on dry land protected by the vegetation, which we see described in these verses as well.
Hmm.
So there's my perspective on the hippopotamus.
So my problem with the hippopotamus is that is it hippopotami?
It is hippopotami or hippopotamuses.
So if octopus is octopi, is hippopotamus hippopotami? I don't know. I don't think it is, but that's what I'm sticking with at the moment.
Okay.
But do you have the answer?
Do I have the answer?
No, I'm looking it up. Plural of hippo is... In English, the plural of hippopotamuses is hippopotamuses, but not hippopotami. You can also say hippos. That's according to Wiki.
I'm looking at the Merriam-Webster, and it says hippopotamuses or hippopotami.
Really?
Yep.
Wow. There you go, kids. Learn something new every day. Anyway. The problem is, though, Ira, is that the hippopotamus is of the family of the pig.
But wait a minute. The Greek, it comes from Greek, hippopotamus, and you know what it literally means?
What? Water pig.
Riverine horse.
Wolverine horse?
Riverine. R-I-V-E-R.
Riverine.
Riverine
horse.
Riverine horse.
But it's not a horse, it's a pig.
What do you mean it's a pig?
It's of the pig family. This is my point. This is what I'm saying.
Where do you get that from? That it's
the hippopotamus is a big giant water pig.
I've never heard that they're in the pig family.
All right, I'm looking it up now. I don't want to confuse everyone. I should have paid attention in biology. Yeah, okay. Until 1909, naturalists grouped hippos with pigs based on molar patterns. Several lines of evidence, first from blood proteins, then from molecular statistics, blah, blah, blah. What do you got?
All right, so what I have here is that some are considering removing... scientists are now considering removing hippopotami from the suborder and reclassifying them in a suborder for hippos, dolphins, and whales, which all seem to share certain DNA. These criteria may be significant to scientists, but I think most scientists would agree that dolphins and hippos are not one family, even if they're the same order and suborder, any more than pigs and giraffes are. Thus, whether pigs and hippopotami share an order or suborder does not seem to be a meaningful factor. From a lay perspective, and this is a rabbinic council that's discussing this.
Mm-hmm.
From a lay perspective, there is some similarity between pigs and hippos, but it would seem that they are not similar enough for the Torah to consider a hippopotamus to merely be a water-based pig.
Fascinating. Well, I always thought...
Somebody was asking the question. Rather, it seems that the answer to your question is that the hippopotamus does not have cloven hooves. A hippo has four toes, which are covered and connected by thick skin, which in turn produce a web effect and aids the hippo in swimming. Thus, a hippopotamus is much like most non-kosher animals, which do not chew their cud and do not have split hooves. But it goes on, and it's a continued article.
So whether it's related to the pig or whether it's related to the dolphin and the whale, either of those, we can't – they're not food for us, right?
So it says, without exception, any animal with a four-chambered stomach is a ruminant. There are those who dispute this and assert that the hippo is an example of an animal that has four chambers and is not a ruminant, but this is erroneous. In fact, it has a three-chambered stomach, parietal blind sac, the stomach, which can be considered simply connecting tissue, and the glandular stomach. So I don't know. It's up in the air.
It's tricky, isn't it?
Trying to see whether or not what the position is on the kashrut laws related to it.
It's certainly not cloven, the split hoof. And so what I'm saying is, if it's a hippopotamus, I'm not eating it. If we end up eating a behemoth, I like to think it's going to be kosher, and I like to think that it's water buffalo. But it's not really what the...
I know, we went off on a tangent here.
But it's, there is behemoth, and now we're in Leviathan, and it says, can you draw out Leviathan with a hook or snare his tongue with a line which you lower? Like, can you go fishing for a Leviathan? Can you put a reed through its nose or pierce its jaw with a hook? Will he make many supplications to you? Will he speak softly to you? Will he make a covenant with you? Will you take him as a servant forever? Will you play with him as with a bird? Or will you leash him for your maidens?
Right, so stop there for a second.
Check it out, girls. I caught a Leviathan. Come and have a look.
So stop there and think about this. Does it not sound like that we're talking about some type of creature that you would be able to leash? Who's going to take a fish and leash a fish? Or sure. Like fish. This is why the typical picture that we get of this would be a crocodile, okay? A large.
I know this now. I know people say crocodile. I don't buy it because we're about to get into some more description that I just cannot reconcile. But it goes on to say, and it says in verse 6, will your companions make a banquet of him? You know, will they eat him? As if that's a possibility, as if that would be okay. I really do feel that Leviathan is some kind of massive elongated fish. Will they apportion him among the merchants? Can you fill his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing spears? Lay your hand on him. Remember the battle and never do it again.
Okay,
indeed.
Wait, stop there again. So are you familiar with crocs and alligators at all?
Oh, we've got some very impressive crocodiles. Sure, not down here, but further up north.
Let me ask you a question. How do you kill a crocodile?
Oh, no, I wouldn't know how to kill him. Okay, I mean, so I just imagine.
So I'm going to tell you how.
Go on, because you got some pretty good. You got alligators, right?
Yeah, we have them in Florida. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's only one way to kill an alligator or a crocodile, and that's there's a very soft spot right on the head.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually about the size of a. Well, I don't know. I could just say in American money, about the size of a quarter.
Mm-hmm.
So when you start talking about this, can you fill his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing spears? You know, it goes on to discuss his back and the way that it comes together, and it's almost like armor. You know, this is why this poetic language really speaks to me about that, because if you see the fact that you can't just shoot a crocodile, you can't shoot a crocodile in its body, you have that one kill spot. As a matter of fact, we have an interesting show here. We have a TV program in the United States that's a reality show called Swamp People. You know, it takes place down in Louisiana where, you know, there was a lot of alligators as well. And this is their livelihood. These people are alligator fishermen. That's all they do in season is hunt alligators. And they catch them on hooks, you know, with like chicken or whatever they use to bait them. And when they kill these alligators, one guy fights it and the other guy has to shoot that kill spot directly, okay, in order to kill the alligator on that one little spot on the back of the head. In order to kill it. So that's why I bring that up.
How big did the alligators get? I mean, what's a record size alligator?
I don't know for here. I don't know what the record is. I mean, the biggest one that I've ever seen caught is probably about 14 feet.
Yeah, okay. Well, so that's pretty impressive. I mean,
it's not unusual. I mean, the house that I used to live in, not the one I'm in now, but the house I used to live in, I lived, I had a lake behind me. And it wasn't unusual sometimes to see an alligator up on the bank sunning himself on the other side of the lake. And it's funny because I take the dog out and sometimes you'd see the alligator. It's not unusual to see dogs attacked because dogs will get too close to the water in Florida. Mm. And I'm talking about in residential areas. I'm not talking like in the outback of Florida. I'm talking you could be as sad as this is. I mean, I have a friend of mine. There used to be a pastor, and we were supposed to get together one weekend for the weekend. We were supposed to hang out together, and I couldn't get in touch with him. And when I finally got in touch with him, it was because one of the families in his church, their three-year-old, was actually killed.
Oh, goodness me.
Their three-year-old behind the house. It was terrible, you know, and he had to minister to the family. But their three-year-old son was by a lake behind their house, and there was an alligator, and you know, they will attack something that small. They will attack a small child or a dog.
Sure, sure. So we unfortunately have news reports from time to time up the north end about crocodiles. And now our crocodiles, I think, can get up to, 4 to 5 meters is not unusual for a large crocodile. So, which I suppose, what's that? That's 16 feet maybe, is that?
Yeah, probably a bit bigger. The crocs are bigger than alligators.
Yeah. So, you know, they're an impressive animal. There's no doubt about it. However, there are some things in here that we're going to get to as I continue to read. It says, indeed, any hope of overcoming him is false. Shall not one be overwhelmed at the sight of him? No one is so fierce that he would dare stir him up.
Right. Now, interesting. Just want to bring up one note before we go on. And that's that you have to notice that we see a change going from God speaking directly to Job in the second person. All along he's been saying to Job, you, can you do this? You know, and now starting in verse 19, there's a change to third person. And so now he's talking just to people in general. He's not just talking, he's talking in the third person. So it's just a slight difference in the way things change going on from verse 9 forward.
Sure. So what it says is, yeah, that's right. So it says, no one is so fierce that he would dare stir him up. Who then is able to stand against me?
Now, who do you think is speaking there?
It's Yehovah, surely.
You think?
Why? What, you don't think so?
There's a possibility that it's not.
Well, who do you think is it referring to then?
Well, we're talking about poetic language, so it could be Leviathan speaking.
But it is referring to Leviathan. Why would it then switch to the first person? As if you cannot dare stir up Leviathan, who then is able to stand against me?
So let me ask you a question. In your Bible, does it have the me capital, M?
Yeah, in this one I do have a capitalized M. I'll just check my other translation. Yeah, I've got a capital M in both.
Okay, just checking, because it's not always in all the versions as a capital. I'm just saying that there are some that believe that the possibility exists that this could be Leviathan speaking in a couple of these verses, where, I mean, it's clear that at the beginning that God is saying no one is so fierce that he dares to stir him up. And again, he's not talking, again, he's talking in third person now, and then it says, who then is he can stand before me? And then in the next verse, it says, whoever confronts me, I will repay or I will reward. Okay.
But then it goes on to say, everything under heaven is mine.
Right. But I'm saying it goes back and forth. Like, in other words, if you look at the second part of verse 10, and the possibility, I'm not saying it is. I'm just saying if you entertain the possibility that it's saying, who then is he who can stand before me? Whoever confronts me, I will reward him. You know, we have the possibility of even Leviathan saying, really? You're going to stand against me? I'll give you a reward if you confront me. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying, you know.
So it goes on in 12 to say, I will not conceal his...
I haven't brought perspective in a long time. I haven't said that. I'm the perspective, remember?
Fair enough.
All different perspectives, and then you get to choose what you want to believe. I'm not saying it's Leviathan speaking. I'm just saying... There's a possibility.
Okay. I will not conceal his limbs. Now, I've got a little asterisk. I've got to check what that is. This is verse 12 in the English. Literally, keep silent about. So I will not keep silent about his limbs, his mighty power, or his graceful proportions. Who can remove? What's that?
It's not what it means.
What do you got?
So the second word in the Hebrew is badav. It says lo badav. And badav can have many meanings, and limbs is one of them. But I'm going to tell you what makes more sense is that one of the translations of that word bad is actually boast. So a better translation for me in context would be, I will not keep silence concerning his boast.
Oh, okay. Fair enough. That makes sense. I think that's fair.
Right.
I will not keep silent concerning his boast, his mighty power, or his graceful proportions. Who can remove his outer coat? Who can approach him with a double bridle? Who can open the doors of his face
right,
with his terrible teeth all around?
All right, so now there's the crocodile.
Oh, potentially. But it's, I mean, look.
Try to open a crocodile. Have you ever seen when they, you know, if you've ever tried, to, do you know that?
If they lock close their jaws, who's going to open it? Sure.
No way. It's not going to happen.
Potentially. Even and it goes on to say.
Down on you, there's no way anybody to be able to get their jaws open to save you.
Sure. Here's his rows of scales. Now, we know he's got scales. We don't know if he has fins. I don't know if anywhere it refers to him as having fins, but we know he's got scales. So scales are his pride, shut up tightly as with a seal. One is so near another that no air can come between them. They are joined one to another. They stick out and cannot be parted. Now, but here, Ira, it all changes from verse 18. His sneezings flash forth light. And his eyes are like the eyelids of the morning. Out of his mouth go burning lights, Sparks of fire shoot out. Smoke goes forth from his nostrils as from a boiling pot and burning rushes. His breath kindles coals and the flame goes out of his mouth. Now, it sounds like, just to read those verses by themselves, it sounds like we're dealing with a fire-breathing dragon of sorts.
Well, okay. So I want to read you something. Because, you know, that's again, you know, remember what we're talking about here. We're talking about the most poetic book in the Tanakh, okay? And so when you're looking at poetic language like this, you have to take that into consideration. So I'm going to read you something. So when you're talking about the sneezing, right, or the idea of the sneezings of Leviathan and this idea of flash of light or lightning, what it says here is that when Leviathan sneezes, the water sprouts up or spouts up about him and catches the sun's rays, okay? And that's why it looks like that. When it says that torches spew from his mouth or fire sparks are released, we don't see any other place that this, I mean, we don't even know how to translate this because there is no other place in the Tanakh that we see anything like this. When we talk about the smoke from his nostrils and this idea of the boiling pot or the seething pot, when we talk about, let's say, for instance, my perspective, where I'm talking about the crocodile, let's say, okay, if you've ever seen a crocodile fight when it's on the hook, okay, it actually looks like the water is boiling because it thrashes about. If you've ever seen, they go into a death roll and there's water flying all over the place. And, you know, it literally looks like that. So I think we have to take into consideration when it says that the breath, you know, is like fires of coal or flame shoots from his mouth. This idea of, fire-breathing dragon or fire-breathing, qualities of Leviathan. Again, we're talking about a poetic description. And so I want to read what this commentary it says. It says, we have the impression of a poetic description of the terror which this monster inspires rather than a recording of actual physical properties. This would certainly be the case if the crocodile is meant, but one feels it would hold true even if the Leviathan of the Agada is being described. You see, they're talking about this being agadic, you know, what we talked about before from Bhava Bhatra. Accordingly, we may surmise that God is teaching Eov another lesson in how to react to life's exigencies. See, he tells Eov how our perceptions are influenced by our preconceived notions. Because we stand in terror of the Leviathan, we imbue it with impossibly frightening properties. With a correct, more objective perspective, we are more readily able to cope. True, a crocodile is sufficiently frightening just as it really is, but there is no need to see fire belching from its mouth. Suffering, too, may be shorn of some of its terror when one is willing to admit the incontestable goodness and justice of the God who sent it. With an awareness of its true nature, it becomes a difficult but a manageable challenge. And this is where we get into that concept that I talked about where God is trying to draw Job out and teach him a lesson about his sufferings and what they're meant to do. And, of course, we saw that throughout this, God is showing that he's just. We saw that in chapter 38 and 39.
So there is also, it should also be acknowledged that I've often heard it said in any case that we know more about space than we do about the depths of the ocean. And who knows what is down there? And if you recall in Finding Nemo, Ira, you've seen that film, right?
Yes.
Excellent animated Australian film. And in there, there is the scene where his father, Marlon, right, I think was his name, is before a what is called a humpback black devil, which is that incredible fish down in the depths of the ocean with the massive jaws and that little glowing thing, and then all of a sudden its whole jaws light up as it's about to pounce upon the fish and swallow them. And it makes me wonder, could it be that something like that may exist in the depths, in the very deep depths and caves of the ocean? Some sort of long, massive, elongated serpent-like fish that has the ability to light up its jaws and to at least give the appearance of some sort of fiery appearance, at its jaws, at its mouth. Something like that potentially could exist because we do see those kind of things in nature on a smaller scale. Is that fair?
Yeah, but there's no, you know, I have no problem with that and no problem with the possibility that that creature exists. But from a strictly contextual standpoint, looking at this chapter, we see the creature that's being described interacting with men in a certain way. Like God is saying that you can't just use harpoons or arrows against this creature and so forth. So, you know, from a contextual standpoint, and then I think, you know, as we move forward here in the next couple of verses, we're going to see that as well, that it appears that man has some type of interaction with this. And mm-hmm. I don't know that that would be true of something that would be in the depths, unless we're talking about that this was something that men interacted with in the days of Job, but not now.
Sure. So whipping through it in verse 22, strength dwells in his neck and sorrow dances before him. The folds of his flesh are joined together. They are firm on him and cannot be moved. His heart is as hard as stone, even as hard as the lower millstone. When he raises himself up, the mighty are afraid because of his crashings. They are beside themselves. Though the sword reaches him, it cannot avail, nor does the spear, dart, or javelin. He regards iron as straw and bronze as rotten wood. The arrow cannot make him flee. Sling stones become like stubble to him. Darts are regarded as straw. He laughs at the threat of javelins. His undersides are like sharp potherds. He spreads pointed marks in the mire, and he makes the deep boil like a pot. He makes the sea like a pot of ointment, and leaves a shining wake behind him. One would think the deep had white hair. On the earth there is nothing like him, which is made without fear. He beholds every high thing. He is king over all the children of pride. That's an interesting verse 34. Isn't that interesting?
It's a very interesting verse, and it just seems so strange because it ends in such an abrupt manner.
Yeah.
By God. We don't even seem to have any kind of closure. It just seems to end. And then, of course, we the next time we're going to deal with the very last chapter where Job actually now answers.
It's almost as if, Ira, it's almost as if Yehovah gets carried away with how impressed he is at his creation, his own creation. Look what I did here. Do you see how incredible it is? How much more incredible you must realize how much more incredible I am. Who do you think that you are that you can even contend with me in such a way?
Yeah, it's very true. It's just, just this ending, though, that I have, he sees everything that is high as king over all the sons of pride.
Yeah. And that's it. That's the ending. That's the ending of chapter 41.
Yeah, the end of chapter 41. And then it's, we're coming to the end, Jonah.
We're coming to the end. And boy, that's those two chapters, they really are mysterious. And they're worth a read, dear listener, and do your own study. But we are coming to chapter 42, where we see finally what happens with Job. And the story comes to a conclusion. We will deal with that next week with, I'm sure, Ira, with some reflection on the entire book.
Yes, absolutely. Do we want to give them a hint of where we may go next?
Go on.
Do we want to save that, keep it a secret?
Let's save it and keep it a secret. We'll do it next week.
We'll keep it a secret.
Okay. Ira Michelson, Torah teacher. The website is, that is so shiny and flash, TorahThreads.com. TorahThreads.com is the website, and Torah Threads, the page on Facebook, as well as Treasures from the Tanakh.
I have one more shameless plug.
Go on.
I have to put out there. On September 1st, I will be launching a new radio show with my friend Rod Bryant. Some of you might know Rod from some other radio work we've done, and we're starting a new show called Beyond the Matrix.
Beyond the Matrix. And that's, so when is that going to start again?
September 1st, Sunday afternoon, 4 p.m. They can go to, there's a Beyond the Matrix Facebook page as well now that people can interact with, or if they want to make it really easy, they can go to www.btmatrix.com, and that will take them directly to the Matrix Facebook page.
Nice. Okay.
With all the information.
So we'll put, when that happens, we'll put links on the Truth to You Facebook page as well, so you can find it there. So we will certainly keep you up to date. That sounds exciting.
Yeah, we're excited.
All right. Keep up to date, dear listeners. Also, make sure you do like the Facebook page of Truth to You. so we can keep you up to date. Truth2U.org is the website. And until next week, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.